In a minute, Mitch Benn will be looking at how Bob Dylan changed what it is to be a songwriter, changed what it is to be a rock star, and more than anyone, perhaps, changed what it is to be a singer. That's after a preview of some laughs from Edinburgh tomorrow.
Hello, I'm Izzy Sutty. Join me for Radio 4's sketch group showcase Sketcharama, coming this week from the Edinburgh Festival. We'll have three sketch acts currently wowing audiences and critics at this year's Fringe. We'll also have this lovely lot. Yeah, I'd give them 3 stars. So join us here at the Edinburgh Festival for Sketcharama tomorrow evening at 6:30 and then available on the BBC Radio 4 website.
It'll be time to say goodbye in the Arches at 7 o'clock. But first here on Radio 4, the musical satirist Mitch Benn explores how Bob Dylan changed what it means to be a singer in The Freewheeling Mitch Benn.
Standing at the microphone to drop myself in and doing 55 years and 28 minutes. Take a whole life trying to encapsulate them. Writing lots of lyrics, learning them verbatim. Culture shock, writer's block, slamming up against the clock. Staring at the deadlines, tick tock, tick tock. Gotta be a finishing, whatever my condition. If I ever want to get another radio commission. Hey there, son, you see what I've done? Ridiculously wordy, but it sounds kind of fun. It's a good place to start, but what makes it really hard is this is radio. So we can't do the thing with the cards. Sitting at the keyboard trying to write the story and suddenly remembering I'm not a rock historian. Can I cover all of it? Can I do him justice? This show is not a documentary, it's just this. Past tense, making sense of his left and influence. Bum raps, bum notes, shifting to the anecdotes. My, my, what a guy, checking the minutiae. Gotta make it speedier, hitting Wikipedia. Hey there, folks, better put in some jokes or the show is gonna feel like an elaborate hoax. I'm trying to pay tribute to Bob somehow. I really hope you like it, and if you don't, well, it's too late now.
When I was a very small boy, well, small boy, certainly, by the age of 4, I used to sit on the living room floor of our house in Liverpool with an old dance set record player. You know, one of those ones, the little self-contained ones you have to kind of fold up into a little Tweedy attaché case. And I sit there with this thing and I basically play the same 3 albums pretty much in rotation. Now, the first was the Beatles' Hard Day's Night album, first pressing from 1964. My mum bought it soon as it came out. Still one of my favourite Beatles albums, actually. It's the first one with no cover versions on it. The whole thing was written by John and Paul. The album sales were used to offset the production cost of the movie, so the movie was already in profit by the time it came out. And I've just remembered I did the Beatles last year. Dylan this week. Snap out of it, Mitch. Okay, where was I? Second of these 3 albums is the only one which is actually mine. It was the first Wombles album. Yeah, the first one, not the later ones with all the singles on. You remember You're a Womble and all that. The first one, the original Wombles album with all the Mike Batt character songs and the extended version of the theme tune with the middle 8. Who knows the middle? Encore Bulgaria, who can remember the days when he wasn't behind the times with his map of the world? Pick up the pieces and make a mess of the review. Yeah. Thank you. Oh, yeah. Some of you are showing your age now. That's good. Now I've got a wavelength thing going on with this one. That's good. Anyway, this was the first record that I ever actually owned. I'd gotten it for my 4th birthday. I still have great affection for this album. When it turned up on iTunes a couple of years ago, I may or may not have downloaded it on the first day. And the 3rd album... was perhaps the most unusual, which is quite a statement when you consider that one of its competitors was ostensibly recorded by fictitious semi-rodentine creatures from southwest London. The cover showed a guy who really did not look like a pop star, certainly not the way pop stars looked in the early 70s, as I was beginning to see on TV at the time. He had like a sort of shabby brown jacket, he's obviously not very tall, frizzy hair, bigger shooter, and a kind of embarrassed-looking smile on his face. Wasn't doing anything pop star-ish either, just shuffling down a wintry street with his hands in his pockets, arm in arm with his pretty but fairly unglamorous-looking ginger girlfriend. But there was something undeniably cool about this guy. And there was definitely something cool about the way he'd incorporated his own name into the album title. The album was called The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan. Freewheelin' with an apostrophe. No G. This guy was so cool he could spell things wrong on purpose. And then you take the record out and you put it on and you discover that not only did the little guy with the big ooter not look like a pop star, he really didn't sound like a pop star. But for much of the record, it's just him. It's just the voice and the acoustic guitar. The guitar playing is proficient, if a bit basic, and the voice is, let's be kind here, it's idiosyncratic, to say the least. He can carry a tune when he wants to. As often as not, he just kind of puts the tune down where he found it and wanders off. And it's all punctuated by occasional bursts of what sounds like a harmonica being, well, not so much played as just sort of respirated through. But the combination was, and indeed is, compelling. The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan was, I learned as I grew older, possibly my mum's favourite album of all time. In particular, she was to confide in me in later years the song Don't Think Twice, It's All Right had helped her get through a messy breakup before she met my dad. This just made Bob Dylan all the more interesting once I'd gotten over the shock of the revelation that my parents were once the kind of people who had messy breakups and not with each other. As the years have gone by, I have been fascinated by Bob Dylan. I realised just how important he'd been, and indeed continues to be, in the evolution of pop music. But you know what? I really wish I'd been around then. I really wish I'd been around when he first emerged in the early 60s. I wonder if I would have got him right away, because by no means everybody did.
Well, his voice is atonal, it's kind of a drone, like there's something got stuck up his nose. Though this song has a melody, it's hard to tell if he actually knows how it goes. He won't win no awards for them straightforward chords. His harmonica style is just breathing, and the verse is just fine till the extended last line makes the scansion strangely uneven. But there's something profound underneath this weird sound. You can tell that it comes from the heart. And it's more when it comes all together than the sum of its less than beautiful parts. There's a simplicity and immediacy that's immediately kind of thrilling. And that's how everyone knew there was something going on the first time they heard Bob Dylan.
One of the strangest aspects of his legacy, if I can just, you know, talk like a rock journalist just for a moment here, is that for all his undoubted skills as a songwriter and his genius as a lyricist, weirdly, perhaps the biggest influence he had on music stemmed from the thing he couldn't really do at all, which was sing. Bob Dylan changed what it was to be a singer for the benefit of the folks at home. I just did air quote fingers around the word singer. In the 60s, Bob Dylan changed what it meant to be a singer just as much as either Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra had in the previous decades. Now, put simply, Bob Dylan made it possible for a whole generation of songwriters and musicians to sing their own material in a way they simply wouldn't have gotten away with in the pre-Dylan epoch. You see, before Bob Dylan, singers were supposed to actually be able to, like, sing. You know, clarity, vibrato, sustain, intonation, notes, all that. Now, Bob Dylan couldn't really sing, but he sang anyway, and it sounded brilliant. And after Bob Dylan, this was all that mattered. After Bob Dylan, an artist like Jimi Hendrix, who for years had been beavering away as a quietly astonishing backup guitarist in soul bands, could be moved centre stage to be the front man in his own right. Now, Jimi Hendrix's voice, much like Dylan's, wasn't a thing of beauty, melodically speaking, but like Bob Dylan's, it was characterful, engaging, and crucially, it suited his music. And in the post-Dylan era, this was enough. So there you go, if you like. There's a little musical James Burke connections moment for you. But by being a dog-rough singer, Bob Dylan indirectly revolutionised lead guitar playing. it's only once you put Jimi Hendrix front and centre of his own band as lead singer and lead guitarist can you make the extended guitar wig-outs as much a feature of the songs as the vocals, and thus the bar is raised for lead guitarists all over the world. So there you go. Heavy metal, Bob Dylan's fault. Led Zeppelin, you are finally absolved. Go forth and squeeze your lemon no more. And there are literally dozens of artists you can say the same thing about. There's the really obvious ones like Mark Knopfler, like Tom Petty, Lou Reed. Definitely Lou Reed. That thing people used to say about Bob Dylan, that he could sing two notes up a bit and down a bit. That was literally true of Lou Reed in the 60s. His voice got a bit more melodic in the 70s. None of these guys would have dared to be their own lead vocalist had it not been for Bob. This has also incidentally led to one of the more selfless aspects of Bob Dylan's legacy, the fact that when other artists cover Dylan songs, they often do it better than him. In fact, many covers of Bob's songs have supplanted his own recordings in the popular consciousness. Jimmy's version of All Along the Watchtower is pretty much universally regarded as the definitive. The Byrds' cover of Mr. Tambourine Man is more beloved than the original. Guns N' Roses' version of Knocking on Heaven's Door is the exception that proves this rule. Hey, maybe even I would not be a singer right now had it not been for Bob Dylan. You see, many years ago when I went to university, I knew that one of the first things I did was I was going to put a band together, right? This is what I was going to do. It took me about a year to put my band together because I spent the first few months looking for a lead singer. Because I had no interest in being a singer back when I was 18, 19. I wanted to be a lead guitarist. I wanted to be Jimmy Page. But like Jimmy Page before me, I discovered that, ironically, Robert Plant's don't grow on trees. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I had a cup of tea and a biscuit after I wrote that one. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So eventually, I guess I thought, sod it, I'll do it. And I assumed vocal duties as well as the guitar duties, boiled my projected hard rock quartet into a kind of power blues trio along the lines of Cream or the Hendrix Experience. And I'm sure somewhere in the back of my mind was the thought that, well, if Jimmy could get away with being his own lead singer, maybe I can too. And that was indirectly thanks to Bob, as we've discussed. And after a while, I just started doing impressions of the voice of whoever song I was doing just to keep myself interested. So that meant that when I got sidetracked into stand-up comedy a few years later, I was already a pretty good musical parodist and vocal mimic, so there you go. As well as accidentally inventing folk rock and heavy metal, Bob Dylan also accidentally invented me. It occurs to me that seeing as this show is supposed to be kind of my tribute to the greatness of Bob Dylan, I do seem to be blaming him for rather a lot. Hope he doesn't get hate mail. But Bob is no stranger to hate mail. For all that he's been lauded for his innovations in the meantime, back when he was actually doing the innovating, not all the innovations went down that well. Once I played acoustically, cause the guitar and harmonica is easily transportable. But I knew I had to change because in bigger rooms I found it was barely audible. I feel completely justified in my decision to go amplified. But some of my fans, they just did not understand. Oh, that's what they call me, sometimes in harmony. There's no forgiveness for my sin. They feel betrayed just because I played on a guitar that was plugged in. The times are changing, but the old school find it strange and they can't handle it. My security could not resist them. They're staring at my PA system like they wanna dismantle it. But it really don't make no sense. Though I get the biblical reference, they've rejected their messiah for the sake of a guitar amplifier. Oh, that's right, they call me now. I broke their heart somehow. Though I'm just trying to be heard.
Nation spokesman. If nobody can make out the words. Oh.
That was fun. And actually, while I'm here, one of the reasons I like doing Bob Dylan parodies is the only time I get to play harmonica. Bob Dylan's the only harmonica player I can play harmonica as well as. It's the same principle as his singing voice, really. Couldn't do it, did it anyway, sounded great. Like I said earlier, Bob Dylan is particularly fascinating as an artist because he presents so many contradictions. And one which only occurred to me as I was writing this is this. As well as essentially redefining what it meant to be a singer, the other big innovation that Bob is credited with is bringing a bit of authenticity to rock and roll. See, till the early 60s, with very few exceptions, rock and roll songs weren't really about anything. Endless variations on the same kind of love song. You had your happy love songs, your heartbreak love songs. But folk music, especially the kind of 20th century agit folk tradition from which Bob Dylan emerged, had always been about stuff. There were still your love songs, still heartbreak songs, but there were political songs, there were civil rights songs, there were anti-war songs, especially once Vietnam kicked off, anti-nuclear songs. And it's largely, if not quite uniquely, through Bob Dylan that this kind of lyrical intensity starts to bleed across from the folk scene into mainstream pop. So the fact that pop lyrics progressed from Moon, June, Spoon to Gimme Shelter over the course of the 60s can at least partly be credited to Bob's influence. He brought the authenticity, finger quotes again there, folks at home, the authenticity of the Greenwich Village coffee bar folk scene into the world of big money pop music. And here comes the contradiction, because for all that he introduced authenticity to pop music, without wanting to be mean about it, when Bob Dylan first turned up, almost everything about him was fake. It was all a contrivance, possibly an unconscious contrivance, but a contrivance nonetheless. Not only had the young Robert Alan Zimmerman renamed himself after a dead Welsh poet, he was a middle-class Jewish kid from Minnesota who nonetheless sang about being homeless in a weird kind of Oklahoma accent, because that's what Woody Guthrie sounded like in the 1930s. The rest of you Google him. And in fact... in fact, while from the vantage point of history, that whole early 60s Greenwich Village folk scene looks like the most quintessentially early 60s thing to have happened in the whole of the early 60s, it was conceived and at the time largely recognised as a retro thing. It was an attempt to evoke the protest folk of the Dust Bowl from the Great Depression of 30 years earlier. Bob may have been, to his evident annoyance, hailed as the voice of his generation, but it's all the more bizarre when you reflect that he was actually trying to be the voice of a previous one. I thought that was deep. Now, you will have noticed that we're about halfway through a show about Bob Dylan, and thus far I've only really talked about the first 5 or 6 years of his by now more than 50-year-long career. Now, I guess this is kind of inevitable, and it's not a reflection on any sort of artistic decline on Bob's part. It's just that when you make the kind of impression, the kind of impact as an artist that Bob did in his early years, that's the bit that people are going to keep coming back to. It kind of holds true of all the big 60s innovators. Whatever they went on to do after the 60s was never going to have the same impact as the stuff they did in the 60s, for the simple reason it wasn't the 60s anymore. That extraordinary era of rapid artistic combustion, when all the rules were broken, when the world literally went from black and white to full colour, when people felt both creatively and literally freer than at any time before or since, and that my generation will never be allowed to forgive ourselves for just having missed. Now, Bob actually did better than a lot of his contemporaries in this regard. He at least managed to keep people interested in what he was doing. Turning up in movies like Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, for which he wrote Knocking on Heaven's Door, the song even Guns N' Roses could not destroy, try as they might. And there was his bizarre Christian rock phase, his motorbike accent, which rendered his voice even more characterful than before. Then in the 80s, he turned his attention to live work, beginning what has since become known as the Everlasting Tour, during which he seems to have made it his mission to never play a song the same way twice. It's easier done by Bob than by most artists, but stories do abound of concert goers halfway through a show wondering if he's ever going to get around to playing any oldies before realising that the song he's actually in the middle of is an unrecognisable version of Positively 4th Street, and he's actually been doing oldies all night, they just couldn't tell. But even if his past career may be, by definition, more interesting than what remains of his career, that doesn't mean he's irrelevant now. In fact, just at the moment, he might even be more relevant than ever. Well, not so long ago in the
called Show. A pop star didn't have nothing to do except stand and smile, freshly scrubbed and styled, and sing whatever the man told him to. Then some of them started to regard it as art, and they tried to go their own way. But through it all, by and large, it's still the man in charge, and that's never more true than today. What we need is a hurricane to blow it all down and start over again. What we need is a tornado right through the middle of this puppet show. Well, ain't it a pity, singing songs by committee and stars by a popular vote? And what none of them see is there's much more to being a singer than hitting the notes. Well, everyone knows that these damn TV shows don't make good music, but it seems to me with the emotions are faking, with their voices all quaking, they ain't even making good TV. What we need is a hurricane, music with soul and maybe half a brain. What we need is a tsunami to wash away the mediocrity.
Since the 90s, after diverting himself with the all-star bit of fun, which was George Harrison and Jeff Lynne's Traveling Wilburys supergroup, Bob has seemingly been content to let himself slip into comfortably eccentric old age, and typically he's found his own way of doing that. Bob's even eccentric in his approach to eccentricity. He's eccentric squared. There's been the wonderfully odd radio show, Bob Dylan's Theme Time Radio Hour, broadcast on BBC Radio 2 in this country. There was a gloriously daft Christmas album a couple of years ago, and he's occasionally been seen indulging a particular hobby of his, visiting the childhood homes of rock legends. Now, apparently this is a thing with Bob. He's been spotted incognito on the Beatles tour bus in Liverpool. Been shown around Paul's dad's house in Fourth Lane Road and John's Auntie Mimi's in Menlo Avenue, trying to pass unnoticed among the Japanese tourists. And there was a hilarious, if possibly slightly apocryphal story came out a few years ago about a family in Toronto calling the police to alert them to the presence of a shabby hooded figure lurking around outside the house, apparently casing the joint. Toronto's finest duly turned up and confronted the figure, who, upon de-hooding, turned out to be Bob, who apologised for any alarm caused and explained that, according to his research, this was the house where Neil Young grew up and he just fancied having a look at it. Apparently mindful of the old saw that you can never go home again, Bob goes to other people's. But loath though I am to disturb Bob in his contented dotage, we need him now. Or at least we need someone like him. Someone to do what he did. See, I learned to play guitar back in the 80s, when lead guitar playing, certainly rock lead guitar playing, had taken a bit of an odd turn. Lead guitar in the 80s had basically become a competitive sport. It was all about playing faster than anybody else, shredding scales and modes at more notes per second than all the other guitarists. And the players themselves became like racing drivers. They were these intensely committed and focused individuals operating these meticulously crafted, precision-engineered machines, trying to beat the next guy's lap time. And somewhere along the way, the fact that this was supposed to be music, that what we were doing was playing tunes, got hopelessly lost. And then at the end of 1991, Kurt Cobain turned up and snapped everybody right out of it. Kurt Cobain didn't play from the heart. Kurt Cobain played from the lower intestine. For most of his life, Kurt was plagued with undiagnosable abdominal cramps, and that is the sound of his guitar playing. It's queasy, it's grinding, it's unsettling. But what it isn't is in any way flashy or showy or indulgent. And so that super-fast lead guitar style went from being the state of the art to looking and sounding extremely silly, more or less overnight. Now, what, you might reasonably ask, has any of this got to do with Bob Dylan? Well, here's the thing. The same silliness which afflicted guitar playing in the 1980s has now all but ruined the craft of singing. Now, if I ever get hold of a working time machine, unlike most people, I will not go back to 1910 and kill Hitler. I'll go back to 1990, and while I wouldn't kill Mariah Carey, I'd give her a rotten cold. Because for the past 25 years now, Mariah Carey has been the benchmark of what is considered good singing. Yes, 25 years. Mariah Carey's been having hits for 25 years. I know, I couldn't believe it when I looked it up myself. Vision of Love, Summer in 1990. Bit of context, Mariah Carey's now been around for as long as Bob had when he did Live Aid. How old do you feel now? But the point is, it is Mariah and all her subsequent copyists and competitors whom singers are encouraged to emulate. It's all about the massive five-octave range, the trills, the melismas, the never singing one note where 23 notes will do, the trying to get 12 syllables out of the word heart. And with the unstoppable rise of the TV singing talent shows, your X thing is your Britain's Got What's It, singing has literally become a competitive sport. And as with guitar playing in the 80s, the fact that this is supposed to be music rather than some kind of bizarre laryngeal assault course has been forgotten. So what we need is for someone to do for singing what Kurt did for guitar playing. What we need, in other words, is Bob Dylan. Well, not Bob Dylan, but somebody like Bob Dylan, or at least somebody to do again what Bob did in the 60s. Change the rules about singing. Remind everybody that it's not just about technique. The technique is just empty showboating if there's nothing real underneath it. And indeed, if there's something sufficiently real underneath it, you don't actually need the technique at all. Now, when I say we need someone like Bob Dylan, I don't mean someone just to come along pretending to be Bob Dylan and doing all the same things Bob Dylan did, otherwise Jake Bugg would have taken care of this 4 years ago. But we need somebody to have that kind of impact, that kind of transformative, almost redemptive effect. Could it happen again? Is there anybody out there who could do it? Maybe Bob himself fancies giving it one more go. Bob, if you're out there, from one BBC radio presenter to another. Your work here is not yet done, my friend. How many years can one man disappear before he is needed again? Yes, and how, yes, how long can we hear lousy songs before we'll go round the bend? How is it still, though he's over the hill, there's still no one like him somehow? Bob said the answer was blown in the wind, but I've looked and it ain't there right now. Yes, and how can it be a whole new century and the world is still marching to war? Yes, and why, tell me why, is there a hole in the sky and no fish in the sea anymore? How can it be we still live nervously in a world that could end any day? Bob said the answer was blown in the wind, but I guess it's blown far away. The Freewheelin' Mitch Band was written and performed by Mitch Band, with additional material by Budgie Barnett. Special appearance by Una Palliser on the viola. The producer was Alexandra Smith. It was a BBC Radio Comedy production.
And Mitch will be back next week to look at David Bowie's legacy in Mitch Ben is the Fat Pink Duke. That's next Tuesday night at 6:30. We'll head to Ambridge after the news, where Tom seems to be in an upbeat mood. And then Front Row will be taking a look at the hip-hop film Straight Outta Compton. Also in the programme, Paula McLean will be talking about her new novel Circling the Sun. And Dan Auerbach of the Black Keys will be discussing his new side project band, The Arcs. That's in Front Row at 7:15. Well, if you're a fan of classic comedy from the 1960s, head over to the Radio 4 Extra, where in Round the Horn, Julian and Sandy will be presenting their Bona Ballet. That is your actual French.
I am unemployed and my husband has abandoned me.
New drama starring Mira Sayal on BBC Radio 4.
You can always apply for a job in another firm as a bookkeeper.
I have applied. but no one is willing to take me on at my age.
Bindi Business, the new series written by Tanika Gupta.
The only way out of unemployment is to become an olderpreneur.
Bindi Business begins next Monday morning at 10:45 and then again in the evening at 7:45.
BBC News at 7 o'clock. Stock markets in Europe and the United States have rallied after China's central bank cut interest rates in an attempt to halt a dramatic slide in share prices. The main index in Shanghai closed down more than 7% today. Experts say the interest rate cut will make it easier for Chinese banks to lend. But these Chinese workers appeared gloomy about the prospects for the world's second largest economy.
A lot of my friends and colleagues are really worried. I hope the government will come out with an explanation of what happened and give us some comfort.
I have no confidence in the economy. Prices are high, wages are low. It is hard to get by.
Prosecutors in France say the gunman who was tackled by passengers on a train to Paris last week had watched a jihadist propaganda video on a mobile phone minutes before the foiled attack. They said it was clear Ayoub al-Khazani had intended to carry out mass slaughter, despite his assertion that he'd planned to rob passengers, not kill them. Labour's interim leader, Harriet Harman, has said she's confident there won't be questions about the integrity of the party's leadership election, despite claims of infiltration by political opponents trying to influence the outcome. Speaking after a private meeting with the four candidates, she said none had criticised her handling of the contest. The former Conservative MP, Harvey Proctor, has strongly criticised the Metropolitan Police after he was interviewed for a second time about allegations of murder and sexual abuse of children in the 1970s and 80s. He said he was completely innocent, and some of the allegations would be laughable were they not so serious. Early visitors to the Dismal Land theme park, devised by the graffiti artist Banksy, have been cashing in on the site's popularity by putting souvenirs on the auction website eBay. Balloons purchased from the attraction in Weston-super-Mare with the slogan, "I am an imbecile," are on sale for around £60. BBC News. Agatha Christie on BBC Radio 4 Extra. A portrait.
Yes, I do find that one's friends are curious about the way one works.
A pilgrimage.
You don't understand. I'm following in the footsteps of Agatha Christie.
And some of the writer's greatest work.
This is important, Josephine. I need you to tell me exactly what you know.
I know who killed Grandfather.
BBC Radio 4 Extra's Agatha Christie season, including close-up Agatha Christie.
You see, I put it all down to the fact that I never had any education.
Next Monday lunchtime at 1:30 and again in the evening at 8:30 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, it may be the early hours, but not everyone's asleep in the Archers.
Oh, morning, Pip.
You okay? It's 5:30. How come you're up?
I could ask you the same thing. You're not milking, are